Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everyone, this is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past, and it is Saturday, June 28th. We're getting down to the end of the month here, and I am broadcasting from Oakland today. Lots to talk about. People, if you have not had a chance to look at the Facebook page and some of the new photographs that were put up on Peru, please go and look at them, because Facebook has changed the format of their page layout, and I post at least two new articles a day and reference material, so they tend to get pushed down, and pages are what they are. I can't do anything about it. I can't adjust them, but yesterday, I posted some stonemasonry work from Peru that is the Hanapacha style. Now, Hanapacha is identified as the oldest of the stonework from pre-flood period. In fact, Alfredo Gamarra, the researcher who coined the term, believes that it is from the Pleistocene period, which is, you know, could be half a million or more years old. And the examples I posted are from Jan-Peter de Jong, the Dutch research engineer, who basically believes that Gamarra has it right, except that Gamarra tends to go a little beyond. I mean, he uses phrases that are kind of religious in connotation, and Peter's an engineer, and so he kind of brings it back to the table and gives it a little better focus. But the examples that you can see in this small gallery are the Hanapacha style, which is probably the most unique stonemasonry in the world, simply because there is something in the stone that makes it appear like it is clay-like. In fact, you can look at a couple of the photos, and the stone is blue, a bluish tint, and it's like someone took a trowel and troweled squares and shapes and other geometric forms into the stone. And so it's fascinating. In fact, it's so fascinating that I'm heading to Peru to meet with Alfredo Gamarra's son, Jose Gamarra. And he has taken up the banner and is considered the expert. So I'll be there in September for over 10 days doing research and photographs, and hopefully to broadcast at least one of the programs with an interview with Jose Gamarra. So take a look at that. That's the title of that is, What is the Hanapacha Style of Stonemasonry? Also, I have added some new photos of the Angkor Wat ruins that are just fascinating. And last week I posted a couple of photographs of some flooring that appears to have been machined. Some kind of machine work was used in cutting these multi-ton blocks of granite. And I'm actually going to be posting some more this afternoon and give you an update. And these are photos that Jan-Peter de Jong took a few years ago when he was traveling through Angkor, through Cambodia, looking at ancient sites, kind of analyzing the stoneworks. So for me, the bottom line on all this is these are unknown, very, very old, prehistoric people that designed these and built these places. Current anthropologists, archaeologists give them dates that are contemporary with Western culture, which is, you know, the Greeks, ancient Romans and things like that. But it really doesn't work with these structures, with these ancient cities in Peru and around the world, where there's stonework that is so sophisticated that the only ones who can identify them with any reasonable focus are engineers. And engineers are the ones who are, you know, taught how to work with precision tools, how to cut with precision tools. And when they come out to locations like Cusco or Sacsayhuaman or Angkor Wat, they see these stones and they look at them and they are mystified because they can see the identifying marks which show machine work. So, and, you know, these are very, very old people. So that brings us to our guest today. And she, our next guest is Susan Martinez. And she has written a fascinating book called The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man, Crossbreeding and the Unexpected Family Tree of Humanity. It's a fascinating book. It's just packed full of material. But she touches on and really digs into ancient man, prehistoric, pre-flood man. And let me just introduce Susan real quickly here. She is a PhD, earned her doctorate in anthropology at Columbia University, where she also served as lecturer in ethnolinguistics. She is the book review editor at the Academy of Spiritual and Consciousness Studies and the author of The Psychic Life of Abraham Lincoln, The Hidden Prophet, Time of the Quickening, and The Lost History of the Little People. She's a contributor to Forbidden Science and Dark Lore. Her work also appears in Atlantis Rising, Fate, and New Dawn magazine. She is coming to us today, I believe, from Clayton, Georgia. Hi, Susan, are you there?
Hi, I'm here in Clayton, Georgia.
Hi. You are in Clayton, Georgia. Wonderful. I'm here in overcast California. What's the weather like in Clayton
today?
It's
just like that here.
Oh, is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Good for you. You know, I have to ask everybody around the country, you know, I talk to people each week that are around, sometimes around the world, but are you dealing with any kind of water issues out there, water crisis?
Cliff, 2 issues ago of the Atlantis Rising magazine,
mm-hmm.
the cover story was Global Drought, written by myself.
Oh, my goodness. So that was a good question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so drought is definitely happening. Our region had drought back in 07, but it's pretty cool right now. In fact, last year's gardens got ruined by too much rain right in the middle of the summer.
Oh, so you have an excess of water then.
We did last year. But our levels are still low.
Oh, they are. Okay. Well, I asked that because California is dealing with drought right now, and it's affected.
I know.
We supply the country and parts of the world with fruits and vegetables, and when we have a drought, it's serious because it affects more than just the people in our state. And so 80% of our runoff of our water goes to the farmlands in central California, and then 20% goes to the city. But even it's really a consideration for desalination, you know, pumping in the salt water, converting it to drinkable water or farming land. And I don't know. But
you know how I got into
curious.
It? You know how I got into it? Because the planet is drying and cooling, and the global warming thing is a complete hype. And that's something I've been writing about for about a dozen years now. But the drought is one aspect of it, drying and cooling.
Well, I hope we have a break in that at some point. We're going to have to change our way of living, that's for sure.
We're going to have to change our way of living.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, this book that you've written is fascinating. I have, it's just, there's so much in there. I was reading chapter and I was rereading chapters, and I wanted to ask you, you are an academic by education, but you challenge Darwin's theory of evolution right from the get-go. What was the reason behind such a fascinating book? Did you just get fed up with what you had discovered was a different story, or
you know,
tell us about the start of it.
Something like 35 years elapsed between the time I got my degree and the time I started writing that book, and I totally forgot about all of it. But little by little, everything was leading up to writing that story, or maybe I should say rewriting. I only lasted 2 years in academia. I wasn't built for it. So I went off and have been off a bit on my own, independent researcher, writer, all these years. The book previous to Hybrid Man was about the little people, and that went into ancient history, and it went into, you know, quite a bit of paleontology to identify these small-statured race. And by the time I got to the end of the book, it was really leading right into evolution and whether it is a valid model or not. My conclusion was not. My agent got very excited about that aspect of the book and asked me to expand on it, but I was already over the word limit for the little people, so I said, hey, I just got to write a separate book, so that's what I did.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I had to go back on all the paleoanthropology stuff I had learned 35 years ago master it again, and it's very extensive literature. So the project took me 2 years, which is twice as long as a normal book.
Amazing. But let me just touch really quickly on your academic background. We had Robert Schock on our program about a month ago, and he has an actual chapter in his book where he talks about the academic community as it pertains to ambiguous and unusual discoveries. And, of course, Robert Schock is known for his redating of the Sphinx to be significantly
right.
older than it was what the Egyptologists claim. But in his book, he has a section where he describes the problems with academic science and the growing a body of evidence that mankind is much older, that at one time he was as sophisticated as we are today, if not more so. And he basically says that the old body, the old school, has to basically die out before any of these changes are read about in academic literature. And a new group of scientists are brought forth who have more open mind. What do you say about that? What is your feeling?
Well, Schock puts it very eloquently, and in fact I have quoted him on that very topic because, see, he's still in it. He's still in the game, so he sure knows what he's talking about. I've been out of it for many, many years. He's absolutely right. this old paradigm of circling the drain, and how they've lasted this long, I don't know. Darwinism is just about the only 19th century theory that hasn't been completely knocked down by 20th and 21st century science. However, the fossil record was not discovered until the 20th century after Darwin's time, and it disproves the theory. So, you know, there they are holding up this house of cards, and there are reasons. Not just professional pride. I mean, that's a big part of it, but not just that.
Well, yeah.
You see, okay, I know, because this is what I went into and spent 2 years digging into. The reason is religion, okay? It's religion, because they have become opponents in this business of man's anthropogenesis. You know, the creationists versus the evolutionists. I ended up siding with creationism, and that is my point of view. I don't, to put the entire book in a nutshell, I don't think evolution ever happened. What we have with all those different races, they just come from crossbreeding, hybrids.
Okay, interesting. So let's talk about the book. So, You've touched on that you actually directly challenge Darwin's theory of evolution, of selective breeding, and tell us a little bit about what you've discovered in your research that the interbreeding among the different species.
The first thing to look at. You know, you were talking earlier, I was taking notes on what you were saying. I'm very interested in that Hanapacha that you were talking about. You know, Cliff, when you come down to it, everything depends on your timetable, on the chronology. Everything depends on the dates. Okay, you know, so this is the ultimate area where we can refer to what was happening when. Okay, as far as the fossil record of man goes, the critical thing is to determine when these specimens were living. So if we go back to the very earliest hominid, among the earliest would be Africa's Australopithecus. There are even a few earlier types, but we can take Australopithecus as a standard of the earliest type of man. If Australopithecus evolved, quote-unquote, into Homo erectus, which in turn evolved into Neanderthal, which in turn evolved into Cro-Magnon, that would be a linear succession, wouldn't it? In time?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. But the fact is, to put it in one word, coexistence. I spent quite a bit of time on that in the book because it's so critical. When Australopithecus was living, there were also anatomically modern humans living. And the same goes right on down through the whole timetable. These races were coexisting. They lived together, they lived in the same time, so they couldn't have evolved. excuse me. You'll find that the when there is contemporaneous fossils of this kind, they've been kind of pushed aside. You know, they've been blackballed for one reason or another. That's the kind of criticism that Robert Schock goes into
Are you referring to a modern Homo sapien being found around the same area that these older skeletons or unusual skeletons are found?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And here's another thing. Neanderthal is generally classed into two types, classic Neanderthal, which is the brutish caveman type that we're familiar with, and a more refined type of Neanderthal with freckles and not such heavy brow ridge and so forth. Guess what? The more refined type is earlier than the classic Neanderthal. So we get these anachronisms all throughout the record that are telling us something is wrong with the concept of linear or even branching evolution. You know, they have gone from a tree to a bush to a network, and finally they're just begging to be part of an interbreeding, network.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, though. Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go on.
No, I was just going to say, you just brought up interbreeding, and in your book, you say there really is no missing link because there was interbreeding, and there isn't any separation. They all are there's a complete development of different kinds of humans. Is that correct? Is that what your theory is? Okay.
Yeah.
And you base that on the skeletal remains that have been found in various parts of the world.
Oh, yeah. You know, Neanderthal in particular. You know, Cliff, my book is not the first one to refute Darwinism. There have been excellent books written over the past 50 or more years, very fine books, maybe 8 or 10 of them, who did a swell job disproving Darwinism. But I will tell you this, none of them seem to have the alternative, and the alternative is so simple-minded, so simple. It's just crossbreeding of the races.
It's amazing. Tell me, this is something I found quite interesting in your book. You have found that in each continent, there was what you term a Garden of Eden. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I find that fascinating.
Here's where we get right into the creationism. Because this is a contest between believers, many of whom may well be creationists, versus the scientists who do not allow religion into their precincts. And certainly creationism is not allowed because their explanation for life on Earth is evolution. I just lost track of my thinking. Why don't you help me?
Yeah, we were talking about the multiple gardens of Eden. Each continent the development. Yeah,
got it.
So I'm curious about that
okay.
Hypothesis.
Let me try to. I'm trying to make myself clear. Evolution side. Is basically a linear succession out of these types that evolved in Africa. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then from Africa spread out to the rest of the world. Oh, boy, could we talk about that. But that's only part of it. In other words, the scientists, right along with the biblicist, actually, is saying that there was a single Garden of Eden. Okay, on the other side of the story is the creationist who might accept the idea that when creatures were created, they were created everywhere, in every part of the world. In other words, resulting in multiple gardens of Eden. You know, not just Australopithecus in Africa, but very early hominid types in America as well, in China, and quite a bit has come up to validate that. So I believe in gardens of Eden everywhere. I think that the single garden is a myth, belonging both to the biblicist and the scientific community.
Interesting. So there are different types of humans living among each other in the Americas, in the European continent, and because I know in parts of Europe there's very old specimens of humanoid beings. Of course, Africa is where Leakey did most of his work, and then recently in South America they found a very old female skull that is in the millions of years ago.
Lucia, I think it is. And her cranial features resemble that of the Melanesians out in the Pacific Ocean.
So, what would be your thought behind the inception of humans? Remember, and you must know about Zachariah Sitchin's story of the Anunnaki coming and breeding with ape man, and then their genetics basically are the starting point for where we are today. What's your take on aliens starting the human species?
When it comes to that topic, I get my scenario from the OWASPE Bible, which covers the records of the races as well. The scenario there, it's kind of a long story. Let me try to make it as short as possible. This planet, the very first race on this planet was similar to the Australopithecus type. For short, we called them Asu man. And it was almost a subhuman creature. It was human, but not with the intelligence or consciousness that we think of today. A tree-dwelling, bipedal, but sometimes scampering around on all fours. Not using language, per se, you know. Here's where the heavenly work comes in. The gods and goddesses wanted to see man rise up to his capacity. So he called for volunteers from the spirit world to come to Earth and help uplift this tree-dwelling man to consciousness and knowledge. This was done. It was done in the time of Simu, and Simu represents the formative period on Earth when the angels could manifest, could take a corporeal form. And that's what these volunteers did. And although their mission was to teach and uplift, once they got corporeal bodies, they broke the rules, and do you know the end of that sentence?
Oh, yeah, Adam and Eve, yeah.
Well, yes. They broke the rules and did mate with the autochthonous man. The product and the...
Okay.
What's funny?
Well, autochthonous.
I mean, funny, I want to laugh. A toxinist?
They are toxinists. Yeah, he's a toxic man, basically, right?
or
the toxic ape man.
No, or toxinist. Or toxinist, that means of the earth. They were earthmen.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about toxic man. Okay.
No. It's kind of a Greek word. Let's just call them earthmen, you know.
Okay.
The Asu. They weren't toxic. They were innocent, really, you know. It's us who are toxic.
Pardon me. Yes.
anyway, where was I? Okay, so...
You were talking about the breeding.
Yeah, they did breed. They did breed with the Earthmen, and the offspring were little people. They didn't attain the height that we have today. They were only 3 feet tall. Probably the reason for that was because the volunteers who came from other worlds were spirits of those who had died stillborn or in infancy. The genes were still not developed. So this is my version of Anunnaki, and OASPE's version of Anunnaki. I don't see them as ancient astronauts. I see them as spiritual beings who fulfilled an assignment on Earth, but broke the rules and interbred with their pupils.
Mm-hmm. So that is an oral tradition from a native people that you basically have gained that information from. Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
When you go into world mythology, you have the sky people on every hand. You have
exactly.
It in Greek mythology, Zeus, you know, all those horny Greek gods come down to Earth and mate with the fairest women. But this extends to American Indian lore and really all over the planet. Sky Father, Sky Mother, Star Woman, there are dozens and dozens of examples of this story. None of them tell it quite the same, but they all boil down to the same thing. We're heaven-born. We're a mixture of heaven and earth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in your view, if you could give a rough time period, would you say that's a couple of million years ago, a few hundred thousand years ago? What would you say was a time frame when these... when the blood of the gods was intermingled with the people, the beings of Earth.
Cliff, that's another subject because, you know, as I said a few minutes ago, time is everything for interpreting proto-history. I have, after years of studying this, I have come to believe that we're way off in our time estimates, not only for the races of man, but for the for the Earth itself. There's another article I wrote in Atlantis Rising about 3 or 4 issues back about the timekeepers. I forget the title of it, but that's where I launched into that problem. I don't think the Earth itself is any more than 30 or 40 million years old, whereas we are taught in school that it's 4.6 billion. Anyway, getting back
right.
to mankind, I'm of the same opinion, and I think things have been egregiously exaggerated. And part of that is to allow for Darwinian evolution to happen. You need all these millions of years for a species to evolve because, you know, it's a gradual process. Evolution is a gradual process, notwithstanding punctuated equilibrium, which is a separate topic. But, okay, I'm going to answer your question. Again, I turn to the... OASPE Chronicles, and I date that the star people coming down to no more than 80,000 years ago, probably 75,000 years ago.
75,000 years ago. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Now, when I wrote The Time of the Quickening, that was the book previous to the Little People book, I went into those dates, and I believe that the and that goes back to an Egyptian system that was developed 12,000 years ago. In that system, the Egyptian civilization fell at the midpoint of man's tenure here on Earth, and that was 72,000 years. So that the total tenure of man's time on Earth is 144,000 years. That's a magic number, and you can do a lot with that. So mm-hmm. we've only got about 75,000 years left in this scheme. It's part of a larger scheme, is what I'm trying to say, of prophetic numbers.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm quite interested in the chapters where you outline the pre-flood people, and specifically Mu, Lemuria. You focus on Churchwood's work, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about the people, the pre-flood people that you have discovered. Can you tell us about them?
First of all, let's not use the word Lemuria. Sorry. I've been checking into that lately, and that's no good to use for the Pacific, because Lemuria, you know, depending on who was writing about it, who was talking about it, it went into the Himalayas, it was part of the Indian Ocean, it reached to Africa. It's very confusing. So I'm doing away with the term Lemuria. I can use the word Mu, from which Churchwood adopted. It's good. There are many linguistic trails of the word Mu all over the world. I've been charting that. But my preference is to use the word Pan, which comes from the OWASPE accounts. I got used to using the word Pan, so that's what I'm doing, and I'm calling the study Panology, as opposed to Atlantology, as opposed to Atlantis. I don't believe in Atlantis, and I think all the interesting stuff of the flood has been shifted toward Atlantis, whereas it really belongs in the Pacific Ocean.
Hmm.
Okay. The date I put on it is 24,000 years ago, the submersion of the continent of Mu or Pan, 24,000 years ago. All that is left is the mountain peaks and so forth, making up the 25,000 islands in the Pacific Ocean. The main gist of the work I do is to study the settlement pattern of those who escaped Pan, and many millions perished in the sinking of that continent, but one select group did escape. And it's the same as the story of Noah and Noah's Ark, but it's been, you know, corrupted and distorted over time. 24,000 mm-hmm. years is a lot of time.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
P.S. The survivors were the little people. They were the sacred little people.
Okay. So what was the development that you've discovered on Mu? Was it Did it reach a technological sophistication, or, as many writers and historians have discussed, it was more of a spiritual place where levels of high spirituality were practiced? What is your feeling on that?
History that I've been tracing says that there was a great deal of warfare and genocide in the entire world in the period preceding the flood, okay? And the barbarians, some of the mixed offspring of these, you know, these fossil types we have, Neanderthals and backbred Cro-Magnons and so forth, they were barbarians, and the Homo erectus as well, and they persecuted the little people and finally genocided them. They were wiped out on every continent. However, on the continent of Pan, there was still a remnant of the little people, and they were hiding out. They were hiding out in the mountains. And here's where the story of Noah comes in, being warned of the flood, and many world traditions do have the story of the warning of how their ancestors were warned that a flood would come, and so they built these mighty boats to escape. I believe that is what happened on Pan, that they escaped, not in a single cube of a vessel, as most of the descriptions give Noah's Ark, but that they escaped in several fleets, with many ships in each fleet. And that's how you account for the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem arriving on the coast of India, Ham arriving on the coast of Africa, on the east coast of Africa, and Japheth arriving in China. In addition, there was a small fleet that went to Japan, and a major fleet that went in the opposite direction of all the other fleets and landed in Guatemala, the Middle Kingdom of the Americas.
And what, so that would be before 24,000 years then, right?
Just around 24,000 years ago.
Now, that's interesting that you have traced all those sons of Noah, all those figures, to around different parts of the world. I'm fascinated by the Mayan culture, but when I go down there and I visit the Central American ruins of the Maya, to my mind, they're significantly older, and from an anthropological point of view, there's racial types that just are not discussed in current annuals. And I think it's just the fact that there's Caucasian, Asian, African, other styles or other racial types there that seems at one time, thousands of years ago, it was a central hub. And so I'm not sure that those types of races lived in Pan, but it's fascinating to me that...
Yes, they lived in Pan, but the only survivors of Pan were the little people, and they were white, they were Caucasian, they had white hair or yellow hair, and they had white skin or yellow skin, and they were 3 feet tall. But
well,
the indigenous people in each of the continents were like what you were describing. Plus, you know, there was a global maritime civilization that the textbooks just don't know about or write about. But it was there, and ever since the time of Hapgood and Barry Fell, and those people came out with their understanding of ancient maps and ancient voyages, we have to see that well before the Phoenicians, this was going on. The Phoenicians were the tail enders rather than the beginners of global navigation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, it's fascinating. So, so the book outlines this constant interbreeding of these ancient humanoid types. Today, I mean, there's tribes in various parts. There's pygmies that are very small people in Africa, and there's the different colors of people. But it seems to me that the majority of humans on the Earth today are Homo sapiens. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, so what happened to these other races? Yeah, go ahead.
You know, even though the sacred little people were forbidden to mix, they broke the rule on several occasions and did mix, but they were forgiven for it because it achieved a happy result, which is that with the more mixing that every tribe on Earth got to have enough genes of the original sacred people to be classed as Homo sapien and to be capable of higher consciousness.
Hmm. Okay. That's amazing. Your chapter 6 is a fascinating chapter. It's called The Timekeepers, The Uncertainties of Scientific Dating. And that has been a huge problem for me because in my research of the Mayan culture and some of the other Mexican, Central American cultures, they tend to take organic matter at the surface level, date it, and use that date to have a chronological period or an inception date for a people. And it's funny that you describe this, and I'm just curious, what is your biggest issue with the dating system that is in place right now? I'm just curious to hear.
You know, it's a paradox because in the standard model, they're dating mankind and the Earth itself way too old, but when it comes to archaeological dating, they're dating it way too young.
Yes.
Civilization did develop in the Americas 24,000 years ago when the enlightened little people landed and settled and mixed with the indigenous people. So here's the thing. You know, if they're taking samples, if your archaeologists are taking samples from a temple, they got to dig under that and find the temple that it was built over, and dig under that and find the temple it was built over, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Because this is what the ancients did. They built on top of the old temples.
Right.
And all we're
exactly.
seeing is the tip of the iceberg.
Which drives me nuts because as new younger archaeologists go into the deep jungles of Central America, they're finding much, much, much older ruins. Now, the archaeologist who's in charge of El Mirador in Guatemala, an ancient Mayan site, has now dated the Maya to be contemporaries with the Olmec. And
yeah.
That's not brought out. That's not brought out it's not discussed in the scientific community because it begins to change the historical references to the development of the Mayan people and the Olmec people.
Yeah. The Olmec are always cited as pre-Mayan people. And
right.
There's also the Puuc, P-U-U-C. They are
right.
pre-Olmec. So, you know, we haven't dug far back enough to know, but when we do, it'll get to be around 24,000 years old.
That's fascinating. So you, in your mind, you have no question that there's a very old people in the world. Now, with that in mind, what do you find the date for the flood? Are you still, do you believe it's the 9,500 BC, which is roughly 12,000 years ago? What is your dating for it?
I have a lot of problems with that, Cliff, because they're mostly basing it on the end of the Ice Age, and I've got a problem with the Ice Age.
Okay.
I've got a chapter on the non-existent ice ages in my forthcoming book called Delusions in Science and Spirituality. That'll be out in the spring. And I devoted each chapter in that book to another delusion. Chapter 3 is the Ice Age. I just don't see how a planet can get hot and get cold and get hot and get cold like a machine, like a refrigerator or something. I don't think ice ages are. I think that's another paradigm circling the drain. It's a separate thing, issue to discuss. You know what cold periods were about, and yes, they were a cold and dark periods on our planet. But ice ages, no.
Okay.
Most of the literature that you will find today will place the alternative literature I'm talking about will place the flood 12,000 years ago, and will furthermore call it the sinking of Atlantis. I don't go by any of that. I'm on a different track here. I think it was twice as long ago as that, 24,000 years. I've got some evidence I've been trying to pile up for that, and that the continent that went down was not Atlantis, but it was Mu.
Okay. And what was the, if that's the case, what was the cause of the global flood or flooding of Pan?
Okay. I knew you would get to that. I could tell. And I would say, first of all, that it wasn't global. I think that's another misconception. You know, it's just one misconception after the other. But I'm trying to clarify. It wasn't global. Sure, there was a flood in in Mesopotamia 4,000 years ago or 6,000 years ago, whenever it was. Sure, there was a flood, but it wasn't the flood. Sure, there was a flood here, there, and everywhere. There have been inundations that have been chronicled in the mythology of people all over the world. But the Great Deluge, the big one, the flood, was not worldwide. It was simply the sinking of the continent of Pan. And that's where it gets interesting, because I don't believe it was a natural disaster. I can start with the myths of the world's people, where also in the Bible, I believe, where the God, it is portrayed that the gods were, it was the wrath of God for sinful mankind. And that's something I've been studying lately and writing about. Well, I do believe it was the action of the gods that caused the flood. But I don't think it was the anger of the gods. The gods and goddesses are beyond anger. It's only demons and the lower spirits that are capable of anger. There was a reason for wiping out the sinful humanity and starting with a clean slate. And I think that's what happened. There is an extensive passage in OASPE describing how these thousands of gods and goddesses used their starships to compress and ultimately crush the crust of the earth and subsequently causing the sinking of the land.
So it was some technology they used to pulverize the earth's mantle or crust or something, huh?
Yeah. You know, when you were talking about technology, when you were talking about Hanapacha.
Hanapacha style, yeah.
How do you spell that? H-U or H-A?
H-A-N-A-N-P-A-C-H-A. Hanapacha.
Okay,
means
got
first,
it. Got
first
it.
World.
Yeah. Yeah, you were talking about very machine-cut rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a constant problem for people like us, isn't it? You know, the technology of the ancients. It's constant.
Exactly.
You know, we don't know. We don't know what they did. But I don't think they had machines. We're machine-oriented because we live in the machine age. But we're rapidly leaving the machine age and going into the into the electronic age. Well, that's why I think we are at the destiny point, because that is what I think the early technology was. I think they had etheric technology. I don't think they had machines, but they had...
Well, that would be more mental than mental states then, right?
Focused? No, the etheric energy is on a level with atomic energy, but they knew how to manipulate it.
Hmm.
And the other thing you said was so interesting to me when you said that those bluish, that bluish stonework was clay-like, you know, because...
Yes, it appears to be clay. It appears to be a rock that is frozen in time that has a clay-like appearance, and there's examples of it throughout Peru and other parts of the world we've discovered.
I know. There are some authors who have wondered if these great, 20-ton monoliths were, in fact, some kind of conglomerate, that's something that they put together.
It's hard to tell, because the biggest problem that I'm finding is that whatever science was used is so amazing that it's almost like they were able to create the rock. And that's the example. Hanapacha is a design, appears to be a formulated man-made rock. But
you know, that is such a breakthrough if you can follow through on that. Nobody knows how they did it. How could anybody lift it without wheels and heavy equipment?
The one key may have been given to us by a man who just passed away. His name's John Burke. And John Burke used electromagnetic measuring devices to measure the frequencies of many of these megaliths. And as it turns out, the ancient people had an extreme acute sense of Earth's gravitational fields, and built many of their pyramids on top of areas where natural occurring emissions would leave the Earth and shoot up. And they built on top of that, and the technology that their designs of these pyramids were such that these pyramids actually collected and amplified these natural emissions, and actually the people who built them were able to use them in a number of ways. Now, the interesting thing about Burke's work, as it applies to the Hanapacha technique, of stonework is that there have been some researchers that have discovered that these megaliths do give off certain signatures of electromagnetic energy. Now,
right,
the thing
like
is
at Sacsayhuaman, they put a compass in it, and it goes wild.
It goes wild, yeah. It goes wild. So it's hard to say. That's why I'm going down in a few months with some equipment to actually begin testing this, those Hanapacha style, because those formations may be built on emission points. And if that's the case, then those places that have seats were actually places to sit and absorb energy for certain reasons. So it's hard to say.
You're on to something. That is great. I want to hear the follow-up on that.
Well, it's going to be actually we're working on a book.
Breakthrough.
Yeah. I think the breakthrough started with Alfredo Gamara, who passed away about 20 years ago. But he was the first one who termed Hanapacha and Hunapacha and then the other types of stonework that were preceding the early periods. And he was a researcher who didn't have, I mean, there was no tools to measure anything except for magnets, and he used magnets on a lot of these places, and the magnetic attraction that a lot of these stoneworks have is out of this world. It's just amazing.
Yeah,
so,
you know, because the local myth says that the stones floated into place. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that they developed the art of levitation. It means that they hooked into these regions of Earth that had a counter-gravity effect.
Yes. Yeah.
They exploited something that was there because they were developed in etheric science.
Yes. Yeah, I firmly believe that. But let's continue with your book because this is what we're here to talk about. And I want to talk about Chapter 9. Chapter 9 is Mutants, Monsters, and Morphogenesis. Now, I want you to talk about that chapter because in it you show a lot of different monsters that are termed monsters. Are you saying that those are actual beings that actually lived on the Earth?
Are you talking about humans or animals?
Well, mutants.
I don't remember what I wrote in.
Oh. Well, it's mutants. Mutant. They're like creatures with tails and high, you know, and fins, and it's just amazing what you have described it here.
No, I don't remember writing about that.
It's called The Worm Who Could Be Man. I mean, it's just
what I'm lashing out at there is the idea of mutation, because that's what the theory of evolution is based on, that some little gene mutates, and it's a positive mutation, and it's selected by natural selection, and that's how we evolve. That's how things evolve. And I'm shooting down that whole argument of mutants. There were very beastly forms of human beings at different stages in our history. Very shaggy types of humans, but they're not a major part of the story, and they were done away with in the era of Apollo. That was 18,000 years ago. That's where the whole idea of temples of beautification came from, in the era of Apollo, that the Homo sapien was formed in that time. And that's congruent with the appearance of Cro-Magnon in Europe.
When you say form, you mean that that's more the genetic engineering, you mean?
Not exactly. The races were inspired to mingle in such a way that a better offspring would be produced.
Interesting. Well, in the few minutes we have left, is there anything that you would like to tell us about this book, The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man, that you think is something that most people should know about, that they probably wouldn't read in regular publications?
Well, nothing that I haven't said, because I think you can just throw away Darwinian evolution and come to an understanding of what a colleague of mine calls the Nookie factor, the interbreeding. Mm-hmm. I do, however, feel that the reason this house of cards has stood so long is because the only alternative is a kind of religious one, or you could say a spiritual one. And that's what the contest is really about.
Okay. And, of course, I have to ask you this final question, which is, what do you see for the future of man in terms of his evolution?
Well, like I said, we've got 75,000 years left, according to the winter tables of the Egyptians that, you know, was developed 12,000 years ago. According to that scheme, we're halfway through. We're more than halfway through. We're in middle age, and we're getting toward old age. And that, the weather and what they ignorantly call climate change without knowing what the heck it is, that's a big part of it. Things are changing in the vortex of the Earth, the bubble that the energy bubble that surrounds the Earth. So we better get onto this new science and this new understanding pretty quick, because the solutions we're putting out right now are not going to cut it. But I do want to say, since you asked about our destiny is, before we leave this planet, is to be spiritualized. And that is what's begun to happen in our own day and time. That's what's happening now. There's a new paradigm coming. War will end. It may take a little while, but I don't think it will take that long. I think things have gotten pretty desperate on our planet. And I think within the next 35 years, we're going to see a major, major change. So the sooner you admit what's going on and look at the alternative ways to live, the better off you are.
Okay, those are good parting words. Let me just ask you, Susan, where are you going to be speaking? Is there any place we can see you speak in the next month or before the end of the year? Or are you scheduled to be in any programs that people can come and see you at?
I'm going to be speaking October 12th at a conference called Mystery of Mysteries at the Edgar Cayce Foundation in Virginia Beach.
Oh, yeah, wonderful. Yeah.
I have their 800 number, or I have
their... Sure, you can give it out if you want, if you have it.
Yeah, it's 800-333-4499. Eric Von Doniken is going to be there, and Andrew Collins and John Anthony West. So it's going to be terrific.
Wonderful, wonderful. So great having you on the program. The book is The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man, Crossbreeding, and the Unexpected Family Tree of Humanity by Susan B. Martinez, PhD. Wonderful having you on the show. Thank you very much. And I will definitely have you on again for this new book. This new book sounds fascinating. Which I guess is going to be out the spring of 2015, is that what you said?
That's right.
Wonderful. Well, thank you.
And I want to stay in touch with you.
Oh, Well, you're welcome to. We can touch
base. I want news from Peru.
Well,
are you practicing? Are you practicing your Spanish?
Oh well, my Spanish is broken at best, but I make by. And you're right; I should keep practicing it because there are times I've been caught in the middle of a Yucatanian jungle, and all that are out there are people who speak Spanish, but. Most of them speak various dialects of Maya, so that's
right,
even a more
right.
more of a challenge. That Maya is a challenge. So we get by with the sound language. I'm waiting for the day that they can develop a device where, and they have a very rudimentary form of one. It's an oral translator where you actually speak.
Oh,
in,
yeah.
You speak
Wonderful.
In it, and it actually describes what you're saying, and they have a very rudimentary form of it right now that Google is working on. And I just heard the other day that they have a version 2 which is so fluid that it's like you're speaking the dialect naturally. And that
is incredible.
Well, that kind of stuff is what I need, because when you there's like 70 Well, excuse me, there's about 100 different Mayan dialects, and there's parts
yeah.
of Chiapas, Mexico that I want to go to, and there's various areas that have many, many ruins that, and you have to go through these various Mayan villages, and it would be nice to be able to speak with them to tell you where to go, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's I don't pick up languages very well. Some people pick up languages really quickly and they can, you know, get going.
Right.
I speak better cat and dog than I speak Spanish. So
okay.
But anyhow, it's been a pleasure. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just saying, buena suerte and lots of luck.
Thank you. And listen, Susan, we'll be in touch again, and I'll stay in touch with you. And best of luck on this book. And I think it's a great breakthrough. So wonderful having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
So, yes, thanks. So stay tuned next week. We have a researcher who has written a book called Ancient Mississippi. And he has discovered relics of Egypt and Phoenicia that are mind-blowing. And I'll be posting some information about him shortly. His name is Brandon Hurd. And his work is based on the early work of Barry Fell, Dr. Fell. And if you want to read an amazing book about America, read America BC, which came out almost 30 years ago. And I just discovered it as a suggestion from our guest next week. And he basically shows that America has been populated continuously for thousands and thousands of years. And that there is a cover-up, which we kind of know about. so anyhow, that's next week. Check in and do join us. So best wishes to everyone, and we will touch base again. Have a great day.